from your tip sheet, I'm going to use that little description of the book so that we can kind of set people up for what they're in store for.
Great.
And they can like do the cross, the sign of the cross before they start hearing you.
I'm Alex Higley.
And I'm Lindsay Hunter.
And I'm a writer. Writer
bud. Welcome to I'm a Writer, But. Today we have Tim Jones Yelvington. Tim Jones Yelvington is the author of the fiction volumes Don't Make Me Do Something We'll Both Regret on Texas Review Press. This Is a Dance Movie on Tiny Hardcore Press. Strike a Pose, Memoirs of a Lit Diva Extraordinaire on Co-Impress. And Evan's House and the Other Boys Who Live There on Rose Metal Press. And the poetry volumes Become on Your Face from Diagram New Michigan Press and Colton Behavioral Therapy on Gazing Grain Press. Tim's here tonight to talk to us about their new book, Don't Make Me Do Something We'll Both Regret, which is a collection linked by their exploration of queer evil. The mystery of desire and sting of rejection drive a child to violence. Boys enter the forest naive to what lurks within. A pack of pop stars turned lovers strike a terrible bargain to preserve their youth. Its characters are Gnostics and mystics, ogres and queens whose defiance of the normative both liberates and confines. Welcome, Tim.
Welcome.
Thank you. Thanks.
Thank you for coming on.
Absolutely. I'm excited.
Please read to us.
Yes. So I think I'm going to read a very brief passage from a story in the collection called Cathedral Ceilings. That's a kind of queer militant attack on the famous, very well-known Ray Carver story, Cathedral.
Raymond Queerver.
Right.
If you will.
Lindsay, will you, if I read too long, will you whistle?
Blow the whistle. Oh, just like old times.
Your readers know what that means? I mean, listeners. Your listeners know what that means?
I don't know. I mean, probably not. For anyone who doesn't know, I used to host a reading series called Quickies, which was all flash fiction. You had 5 minutes to read a complete story, no excerpts, no poetry. And if you went over even by a second, me and my co-host, Mary Hamilton, would blow a whistle and get you off the stage. And Tim read quite a few times with us and was in quite a few audiences. And it was a really good time. I wish I had my whistle. I would totally blow you off the stage.
I would say around like 2009, 2010, it was the epicenter of my literary community in Chicago. And I also feel like, because you read almost every time, right?
Mm-hmm.
I learned so much, you know, back in the day when I was really into the conversation about like reading as performance and mm-hmm. how to like hold attention. I feel like you were always one of the folks that I held in my head. Kind of an icon of that for me, and just how both like raunchy and filthy, but also just like incredibly beautiful the work you always read was. So
thank you so much. I miss it so much. This is an aside, but I ran into Jill Summers today, who's also a Chicago writer, and she looked at me and she goes, "I can't believe you have 3 kids." And I was like, "I think I must have been really like out of control back in the day." Oh well, I'm back in control, everyone. okay, Tim, I can't wait to hear this.
Great. I run my fingers over you like paper. I go up and down the sides, the edges, even the edges. I finger the corners. They're massive. They're built of stone, marble too sometimes. You find my hand. You close your hand over my hand. Your fingers ride my fingers as my hands stroke your paper. I'm on you now, straddling you. Go ahead, babe, I say. Give it like I'm telling you. You'll see. Press hard, I say. That's right. That's good. Swell. Terrific. Never thought anything like this could happen in your lifetime, did you? Go on now. Keep it up. You're cooking with gas. Suddenly, I'm convulsed, flayed open like a cluster of infected nerves, each touch a piercing. My desire births a shame and my shame a rage. The feeling loops, circles back, laces a knot, a gnarled web. Shame, rage, desire. Desire, rage, shame. This is my condition, not only in this moment, but always in the presence of men such as you, me, a stuck fly, waiting mortified, terrified to be eaten by the spider, a spider that never arrives. My only escape is to expel this hot agony, to obliterate. Close your eyes, I say. Keep them that way. I reach for the nearby table, feel for the steak knife. Quickly, I bury it in your gut, in the tender valley below an abdominal ridge. The canyon floods with blood. You sputter. I take you deep, impale myself, squeeze to hold you tight, to keep you in position. I cover your mouth with one hand to buffer your cry. With the other, I strike and strike again. It uncages something, a feeling I've been waiting, plotting to release since the moment I arrived. I sense your departure, a limpening. You watch yourself from outside yourself. You fly up into the sharp point of your cathedral ceiling. You are in your house. You know that, but you don't feel like you're inside anything. You watch your body, its extension still inside me. I ride, mingle blood and cum. As I climax, here's your cliff notes for you, simple, you blissfully simple man. I am a blind man, a faggot, and I have come to your house to seduce, to kill you, to show you the possibility for change, like nothing else in your life up to now. It's really something, you say.
Thank you for reading that. I want to hear about how you write about sex, because I feel like you're a very exacting, specific, like visceral writer when it comes when it comes to everything, but especially when it comes to sex. And I want to know, like, from you, I just want to know, like, what it's like, what, as you're writing these scenes, like, what is happening for you?
I think that the type of sex or eroticized or et cetera writing that I appreciate most is when there is some real, I don't know, where it generates some real heat, I guess, is like our theater. And I think for me to get there, I don't write it experientially in terms of like thinking about like an actual encounter at all. I don't think I have to do something with language that where it's like the affect of the language, almost maybe more like a, I don't know, a poet might approach it through like sound or so it's usually, you know, like that section actually appropriated and remixed and torqued in a lot of words and sort of bits of sentences from the actual Ray Carver short story. And with additions and other things. And I think that like that's often part of what I do is I'll find some kind of like text generating tool or something to get like some like language to like play or work with that I can then kind of charge through how it's used, I guess. Almost like, I don't know if you like have that metaphor, I feel like a metaphor is like a like the painter's palette and getting a bunch of different stuff on there and just playing with it. I feel like I kind of need to get some words to do that with. So like there's a story later in the collection where I used a cut up method that I borrowed from the writer Dodie Bellamy. That's like quadrants of text where like about a half the page, but in different quarters is like taken from like kind of more like pornographic text. And then you like blend it with whatever other text you want. And then it creates, you look at it and like a lot of the times the actual word, like combined words don't make any sense. So you have to kind of figure out like, what do I see here that isn't on the page? And I need stuff like that, I guess, to get to something that feels like it hits my body. Hopefully the body of whoever's reading it in the way that I'm looking for, at least for that kind of thing.
Tim, is that always a starting point for you? Or is it sometimes that you're writing and the connections or the borrowing is something, it just comes from the fact that these are works that maybe are in your head or that mean a lot to you or that you've been encountering in reading or watching recently? Is it always a conscious, okay, I'm going to, you know, invoke Dodie Bellamy's approach, or I'm going to think about, you know, Flannery O'Connor is a good man, hard to find with another one of these stories. Is it always on the front end?
Not necessarily. I feel like maybe different pieces have different things or like processes driving them. I think I do, though, often need to have, like, I can't write from an idea, but I also don't, I don't do a whole lot where it's like, I don't know, where it's just from like a blank page and text coming either.
Right.
Although maybe in like a way where I'm like maybe pacing or walking around and then language is coming and then I have to get it down kind of. But like usually there's some, often I feel like I'm working with some kind of like rubbing together sort of like a few different impulses that feel like frictive or something in some way. So often I might have an idea like I want to do something about this topic or this thing, and it'll like sit around, knock around like in the back of my head for even like a year or two because I don't have an idea about how. And then I'll have another kind of how hit me in another moment, and then it's like, oh, okay, let's put these two together, kind of, or you know.
Yeah.
It sounds like writing for you is like play, and like it's about like making, like using these things at hand to make something.
Yeah, I think definitely play. And I also I'm really what I really hate doing, or that makes me like really uncomfortable is when I have like maybe like a, you know, that like having like a content or an outline or something that I then have to figure out how to give language to, like where I feel like I'm deciding the words. I like to feel like they're getting channeled from somewhere outside myself or something. And I feel like distrustful when it's not that. And I also think it's maybe because of so much of the writing I have to do in my professional life, like in the nonprofit and sort of social impact sector, is always so so much like trying to figure out the right language that will resonate with like the funder or like you know, the young people that we're like trying to market our summer program to. And I just hate having that feeling outside of work where it feels sort of like labored in that way. I also though wonder about like you know, is there, and is there something I could learn by trying that kind a little more often and like sitting with that discomfort and seeing what happens? You know, I have no shame about the way, you know, the processes that I have used, but I wonder if there's like also, you know, I always like to be kind of evolving and I guess challenging in myself in new ways. So I've wondered if like, you know, if that discipline that, you know, more traditional maybe fiction writers talk about just like that button the chair thing and kind of, you know, make yourself whatever, if that would generate different things that I haven't seen yet.
Is there something that you want to see in your writing that you haven't been able to access yet?
Yes, although I don't know that it's related to that. So my commitments around like political work, I guess, or sort of social movement contribution in my non-writing life are very much about I guess sort of decentering of myself, figuring out how to make contribution to really like radical work for collective liberation, be generating, you know, the alternatives that we want to see in the world. And I don't at all feel like that's something that's necessarily showed up in my work at all yet, or my art. I do think, you know, there's a politics, it probably is a politics to it, but it's been more kind of more I don't know, kind of in that transgressive space that's kind of like you know, very much in the muck or mire of the current, I guess, and my own kind of like obsessions and what I want to indulge. Which has been really fun, like play, like you say, but I think there's a way that I'd love future work to be more in collaboration or kind of contributing to social movement. And I think it may be getting there,
God, that's so much pressure though, isn't it? Like the
but
job that you do, like the work that you do, you know, you're doing it there, but then to do it with your own personal art, so scary. Like, you know, like what you put in might be different than what comes out, you know?
Absolutely.
So I get why you've kind of, you know, been slowly working your way up to it, because that's so daunting.
Yeah, my God. Tim, was the form something that you arrived at with an editor, or when this book was submitted, was the collection broken up into the Old Testament, New Testament, Gospel, and so on? Did you have that from the very start? And did you have kind of a sense visually of how this work would look on the page? Or was that more a collaborative effort between you and an editor or a designer?
Yeah. So the structure that's built around those I don't like what's the right word, like those divider sections, basically, mm-hmm. that are all part of retranslation, you know, a sort of continually retranslated biblical translation, the structure and those Bible passages predate my submitting it and working with an editor. It wasn't necessarily when I was writing the stories, something that I had in mind. That was its own story, like the Bible one, that was, published in the account. It's actually one of the oldest stories in the collection. And basically when I was trying to figure out an order or a sequence, I couldn't figure out where to put it. Like it didn't, I was having trouble with like the sequence in general, like figuring out how to, you know, like what, you know, there's some pieces that like, that really kind of speak to each other more directly. And then it was like, do I want to space them out? Or, you know, what kind of transitions do I want here? And nothing was really feeling right to me. And then I was like, what if this story is the spine? And then everything kind of snapped into place.
Wow.
Because it did feel like there was a set of stories that kind of like, at least fit that kind of like stereotypical concept of the Old Testament is kind of vengeful and like violent. And then there was a set of stories that kind of felt like they were a little bit more about like desire and this kind of like almost like love that are kind of in the New Testament section. And then there were the ones that I'm calling the gospel are kind of more about like a type of evil that's more this kind of evil queen glamour and magic of like art and kind of making the world on my own terms and or my character's terms and or the voice people voice in the story's terms in a way that you know, whatever the consequences of that to others be damned, but it's going to be really like you know, glamorous and you know, whatever. And so that's kind of how it got clustered. You asked about the visual though too, so
yeah,
for folks who haven't seen the book, there's the design is really, the internal design especially, is really amazing and far exceeded my expectations. So there are some visual elements that were part of my original stories. Like there's a story that is in the form of a 1990s American Girl novel. boy book about the meme character Alex from Target. That I actually, like the collage, those collages that are in there, I handmade myself.
I was going to ask you that.
Cool. And then, I found the actual, like closest typeface to the original books and like had like laid it out on the page. That, so like that part was me, but there are a lot of the other things in the book, the decision about how to design the biblical passages, the through line of the, like, there's this blood trail that goes on different pages, and as well as some embellishment to the actual, visuals in that Alex from Target story. All of that is was PJ Carlisle from Texas Review Press, who did the majority of the editing and layout for the book. And it far, I never in a million years thought that full color would be possible in anything. So like my original version of those collages, I had like done like black and white photocopies of them and like a real DIY like hand stapled zine aesthetic, thinking mm-hmm. that was all that was publishable. And he was like, let's take this back to the originals. And it's really exciting to see how that came out.
Yeah, when we were waiting for the arcs, mm-hmm. I didn't even think about, because they, you know, Texas mm-hmm. Review Press got back to us and said, you know, we'll have them to you soon, we're still working on them. And I didn't even think twice about it. And then they sent it to us and I was like, oh, this is why, because it is so detailed and so like richly colored, and it's quite something to see.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, I was blown away.
Yeah.
I'm really grateful.
I want to touch on, you mentioned Alex from Target, and there's also Damn Daniel in there, which sometimes I shudder when I think about that time, because I was in the hospital after giving birth to my second child.
Oh, no.
When the Damn Daniel thing took off, and like it made me laugh. I thought it was funny, but I was still, you know, like I had a whole lot of sleeplessness ahead of me. Anyway, I want you to talk a little bit about what these kinds of memes and pop culture mean to you as you're, and there's Pretty Little Liars in here and, you know, stuff like that. I want to hear from you, like, Like what are they giving you in terms of inspiration?
I think pop culture in general, I think I approach from the perspective of like, or my interest in that really comes from maybe like historic and current queer culture and this sort of like insurgent, I guess, practice of taking, you know, the elements of the stuff that you're, experiencing as like an audience, a reader or whatever, that may or may not represent you, and kind of recombining it in ways that do and that create a kind of community and culture around it.
Mm-hmm.
Camp is a big aesthetic influence on me, which I think is a more sophisticated kind of way of appreciating media than maybe the idea of it that a lot of people have. So I think that's a big part of it. With some of those specific examples, there's like three or four, almost like a little suite of stories that are kind of all about, were all written around the same time, I feel like around like 2015, 2016,
mm-hmm.
that are all using like personalities from the media that are all kind of like similar types of youthful beauty, I feel like. And there was, I guess, so like around the time I wrote them, I was turning the same age that my partner was when we first met. So he's about 14 years older than me. So I guess it was about 14 years into our relationship. And when I was younger, never had a lot of interest in, I don't know, that boy band kind of look. And was suddenly finding it kind of compelling at that moment when I was writing those. And a lot of those stories, I feel like, have this kind of like weird relationship to it, where there's a desire, but it's kind of sublimated. And is it really about that? Or is it about me and my own identity? Or is it like, you know, what is like? And so I think that it was what I realized, I think, when I was looking back on those stories pretty soon after writing them, was, you know, ostensibly like queer evil, which is like the theme of the collection, was you know, where I was kind of like getting the ideas and figuring out what would go in the collection. But I think what was actually driving several of those stories was more, I think, like what I was having at the time was like an anxiety about mortality and aging.
Mm-hmm. Did your partner realize that meant you thought he was old as shit?
No, I never thought that. But it's funny how you can be like thinking one thing about yourself and not, yeah. or like what I would probably say is like, I just always took that for granted from the beginning of our relationship.
Mm-hmm.
And I'm having a hard time about that. So,
mm-hmm.
Yeah.
Sometimes Ben and I are like, wait a minute, how old was your mom or how old was your dad when this happened? And we're like, oh my God, they were younger than us. Like, he freaked out the other day because my dad was 37 when, I think when Hammer Time came out.
Oh yeah.
He's like, it was only 37. Because Ben's 45. He's taking it hard that he's 45.
Mm-hmm.
But a young 45.
A very young 45, that's right. Who do you think writes the best about camp, or writes the best camp?
Ooh.
Like who do you love to read that is really good at camp?
I think the sort of like I guess almost like literary ancestors or direct influences that I look to the most are Derek McCormick, who I have an epigraph from at the mm-hmm. beginning of the book, and then folks from a little bit longer ago are James McCourt, who's kind of like been described as like a camp James Joyce. This is all literary camp, I guess, or you know, camp adjacent. The funny mm-hmm. thing about camp is like, if you really go by the like the full Susan Sontag argument, like if it knows it's camp, it can't really be, but these are things that are kind of in the in-between space, I guess.
Mm.
But also Manuel Pig, who wrote like Kiss of a Spider Woman and Memory Mambo, and there's like that element through his work. Pedro Lemebel. Richard Bruce Nugent, who was a contributor to the Harlem Renaissance and wrote this Romana Clef about all of those characters. It has a sort of gossipy tone in places that I feel like has some kind of a little bit of campiness to it. Those are my, if I had to do like a quick kind of canon. Oh, and then one of the early, one of the classic examples is early 20th century Ronald Furbank, who has novels about things like just like pages and pages of these sort of like bougie countryside British women with crazy names gossiping about each other, where the only plot is like a woman who's like trying to have a commemorative like memorial stained glass window installed in a cathedral in her name, even though she's still alive. And you know, like three or four pages will just be describing what they're wearing.
Oh, I love that.
Tim, you were prepared for that question.
I know. I feel like
that was excellent.
Anytime anyone asks me or Alex, like, what books do you, we're like, books.
I guess as a mode of appreciation, like in terms of like campus pop culture, I really, the part of it that I gravitate toward the most, that I think people talk about the least, is like is that sense of like really earnest feeling amidst the kind of that sort of weird like slightly ironic humor with which you're viewing something, but that you also were like deeply identifying. So I think about like my favorite scene in the movie Valley of the Dolls is when Neely O'Hara is like completely lost and unraveling and in the alley and like screaming out her name at the top of her lungs near the end of the movie, wasted when no one will come find her. And there's like a big part of me that's like, I get that. I've been there. It's identification and like the sense of feeling for me, not just, you know, not just the sort of like celebration of the theater and all that. Yeah.
I feel like I read a really good essay about Mariah Carey and camp, but I'm unable to find it with this quick Googling I just did. But I think it's out there somewhere. You mentioned that definition of camp is that if you know it's camp, it's not really camp. Do you, was there anything that you've written where you didn't think it was camp, but then upon a later review realized, oh, this is kind of camp?
I don't know. I don't. Maybe things I wrote as a child, for sure. You know, like I thought were such a big deal at the time, but then you read back and you're like, that was me imitating a bunch of like 80s action romantic comedies.
No shame,
There's
no
a story I
shame.
wrote in third grade called Cute Cop that's
Oh my gosh.
about this quartet of characters, like this like I'm appalled by the cop part now with like my politics, but anyway, it's like a cop and his best friend who then meet this girl and her best friend, and they're somehow all magically each other's dream boys and dream girls. They've been dreaming about all their lives, and then like they all go to a dance together, and then the women get kidnapped by this villain, and they get have a big chase scene in an airport, and like a you know a lighting like a lighting fixture gets shot out of the ceiling and falls on everyone, and, you know, yeah.
I mean, that sounds great to me.
Tim, could you tell us a little bit about the submission process for this book? I feel like it's so obvious you landed exactly where you were supposed to be with this project and had an editor and designer who were so engaged with the work. What was it like getting the book to that point?
I finished it the last couple of stories in like I think around like 2018 or so, and then submitted to like several different presses or contests. I think was only got like good feedback on two. I was like a finalist at NOEMI,
Cool.
and then a semi-finalist in Yes Yes's fiction contest or something, but hadn't found a home at all yet. And then I decided to, against what was probably the better judgment of most of the people around me at the time, and to not cancel my plans to go to what I call the Fall of Pompeii WP in San Antonio in 2020.
Oh God. Oh my gosh.
Which I feel a little bit of like guilt about attending, I think, but it was really fun because it was there were so few people, and a lot of the time was just like me hanging out like on a pool deck with like Lily Wang, eating like eating queso and being stoned and similar things. It was just, so I met Katie Jean Schinkel, who's the founder of this innovative prose imprint at Texas Review Press. And I think had been social media connected, but not really met or ever spent time together or knew each other well. But there were so few people at AWP in general that year, and also even less queers, that we latched onto each other really quickly and became good friends that weekend. And then she solicited me, to ask if I had any manuscripts for this imprint she was starting just a few weeks after we got back. So it ended up kind of just being the perfect, perfect story, I guess, or fit.
That's awesome. Yeah.
I love Katie Jean Schinkel. She's a great writer in her own right.
Mm-hmm.
Tim, do you work with an agent, or are you always submitting, work on your own?
No agent. I've only tried once or twice. I don't have, it's the classic, like, I don't have a novel to submit yet, so I haven't spent much value in doing so. But I did. There was one agent who read this collection and said, something like, these stories have energy, but without a platform. And he defined platform as like basically publications and like the two or three big glossies, right? Like New Yorker or whatever. Short story collections are too hard to sell. I have a history of submitting to small presses, but I'm kind of trying to move beyond them and kind of want to be able to start with big five. So no. Which I like was in my feelings about very briefly, but not for very long. Because part of the reason I'd gone to him in general is because there were folks that I think you and I both know that this person represents that do have like a small press background. And I thought, you know what I mean? I just, I was like, oh, here's someone who will know and get it. But I hit him at the exact wrong time and his ambitions. So,
like, how are we supposed to get in the New Yorker?
Exactly. Yeah, not happening.
I'll do it. Okay. Just tell me how. Don't twist my arm. I'm baffled by that to this day. It's like, it's weird for an agent to be like, well, unless you're in the New Yorker.
Right.
It's like, no, I need you to help me do that.
Right. But I've been on the other side of enough types of things to know, like, sometimes you just need a reason to give people. And so I don't take things too much to heart. It's like, you don't want to work with someone who isn't obsessed with you anyway, right?
So. Exactly. And things change so fast. It's like, I've heard countless stories where it was like, it was no, 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 no. And then all of a sudden, what do you have? Or can we have that thing I saw? It's just, you just never know.
Mm-hmm.
It's so hard. I was talking to my agent, I think I've mentioned this before, where we tried to sell a book and it was all no's. And, he was kind of explaining to me like, why, like the market doesn't want books like these, or they don't think these books will sell. And I told him, I'm like, I should know, I should be thinking about that. Like, I should be, as I'm writing or as I'm revising or getting it ready or whatever, I should be thinking now, how can I make this marketable? And he was like, nah, like, you shouldn't be thinking like that, actually.
Yeah.
He's like, but we should have those conversations once the work is done. So
it seems like there's so much subjectivity even around interpreting what the market is open to too, though, right? Like, it's very mysterious to me.
Yeah, it's hard because I think so often, whatever it may be, whether you're reading for Hobart or maybe you're an assistant for an agent, like vetting queries or something, it's like, it's often one person when it seems like a monolith, and often the one person is not the person you think it is. I think I've told the story on the show before. My agent now, who's been my agent for 5 or 6 years, I had submitted my last book to her, and her assistant at the time just was like, no. And I ended up connecting with her on a different project. And I never asked her, like, oh, why didn't you like the last one? And then I finally was, I asked her at some point, we were talking about something. She's like, oh, because I never read it because my assistant tossed it. And I had just assumed she just wasn't into it. And I feel like there's a million stories where it's like the level of nuance in the know is a lot of times actually even more heartbreaking, because what appears to be one layer is actually six that you have to get through.
Yes.
Gauntlet.
Yes, a gauntlet. Exactly. It's true. You're right.
It really is a journey, a quest. You might not survive. You'll come out anew. So, Tim, have you had the chance to do any live readings from this?
Not since it came out, no.
Okay.
There are one or two stories that are in it that I've read from the last couple times I had a chance to read. So I think that like in like Portland and whatever year that was, 2019. When I was doing readings for the press that published my last book, Strike a Prose, Cohen Press, there are a couple times I used stories that were, you know, a good reading length from this collection. But yeah, I'm going to do Chicago, in-person release party on September 30th. Probably will read then, but yeah, I haven't planned anything else yet.
Where is that event?
Guild Row. It's like a kind of like a cross between a shared, like a co-work space and a like social club. Like if you think about a place like Soho House, but make it like much more neighborhood based and much more somewhat like social justice rooted and much less douchey. It's a little like that. It's in Avondale, right just south of Belmont, in that sort of warehousey area by Belmont and Rockwell.
Are you still showing up in costume in these events?
Some type of in compelling fashion, but the sort of persona I retired more or less after I stopped reading from the Strike a Prose book. Like that was sort of the book that came out of that, eventually came out of that practice. And it felt like the culmination of it, I guess. Something else, so.
Yes, Tim used to walk in to readings and everybody would be captivated because Tim would have a different look for each time I saw you. It would be something completely new, wild, meticulous, incredible.
Yeah, it started as a kind of like sort of Bowie-esque kind of glam masculinity sort of with always I started early on like gluing sequins to my face, a little bit club kid too, I guess. And then gradually that segued into full drag. And the thing that kind of happened was then like I was starting to feel a little bit like this wasn't it cost a lot of money for one thing.
Oh my God.
It wasn't going anywhere in the lit scene. So I was like, maybe I should like I started getting this urge to like try actually making a stab at making a go of it in nightlife and like more real drag. And that happened from about like 2013 to 2014 or 15 or so until I kind of like burnt out on that attempt. But it was a fun time to like try. But it also delayed me finishing that like book that was about the sort of diva persona, because I was also in grad school for youth development from 20, around the same period of time. So I missed out on a lot of sort of lit scene stuff in that period of time. And when I came back, it was like the whole community I knew in Chicago was basically gone. Like we were all in our 30s by then and doing our own thing, right?
It's crazy. Someone asked me recently, like, oh, Lindsay, you probably know the lit scene as well as anyone. And I was like, no.
I don't know anything. Well, in prose, and particularly like prose and fiction, it feels like got completely taken over by the, the like nonfiction storytelling scene, which I like, appreciate, but it's not something I really have any interest in as a writer, and not even that much as like a listener.
Right. People love that
makes
shit, though.
Two of us.
Like, all power to the awesome people like Megan Steelstra and the folks who do that, but it's just not me. So,
well, what's next?
I am working on two things. One is a book that I started kind of mid-pandemic that's a hero's journey in an anti-hero's journey, kind of using the hero's journey format to talk about how much I hate the hero's journey, right? about a quest for Strawberry Fanta. It's called the Strawberry Fanta book. And so one of my other big sort of literary influences is like the New Narrativists. I don't know if you're familiar at all, but the sort of core group or their core time period is like 1980s San Francisco, very queer work that usually has some kind of like meta fictional or auto, what now people are now calling auto fictional element to it, right? So it's like usually texts that are functioning on multiple levels where there's like some element of like lived experience, embodiment, gossip, naming of the people you're in community with, kind of confession. And then layered over that, there'll be like, sort of theory, whether it's like literary theory, art theory, political theory. They were all kind of like queer leftists, and maybe like myth, but usually like narrative is commenting on itself and narrating it itself on like multiple different levels. So that's like the movement, the Dodie Bellamy, Kevin Killian, Robert Gluck, Bruce Boone, et cetera, were a big part of, and it's been a big influence on me. And I think of the books I've written, this one is the most in that vein. Kind of, there's different formal experiments in almost every chapter, and weird things going on with time, and but it's Quest for Strawberry Fanta, but really it's about like mental health, the uprisings, my relationship with my mother that's a little bit fraught because she hasn't spoken to me since 2018.
What?
A lot of different things. So
I'm sorry to hear that.
one of the weirdest things I've ever read, but maybe also one of the most personal and vulnerable. So we'll see. And then the other completely different project I'm working on is a soap opera.
Oh my God, like for TV or for.
Well, so here's the thing is like, I really, all of the narrative elements of soap that I've been a fan and viewer for many years, and I took like maybe a 20-year break from the genre and got re-obsessed in 2021. But a lot of like what I want to do with it as a writer is stuck in the like 5 day a week, 52 week, 52 day a year format because of I really want to like learn how to slow down and do a really character-driven narrative across that span of time and build long story, and have these like moments that these kind of everyday moments that you get of like these people in your living room where it doesn't move story that fast. That's the challenge I want as a writer, but that kind of soap is basically unproducible in 2022 because the genre has been, whittled down to, they haven't made, there's no new soaps happening ever again, basically, right? So it's like, at first I was like, well, I want to do the writing challenge and then I'll figure out if I like maybe do it in prose form and distribute it like in a newsletter format or maybe try to do it as a radio or podcast thing. But then I ended up writing the pilot in screenplay format because I decided kind of on a whim to apply to the screenplay track at Lambda this summer, and didn't get in, but was really grateful for the opportunity to like do something that was all dialogue based and really enjoyed it. So now I'm like, do I care enough about these characters and context that I came up with to like maybe get rid of this attachment to like the
The
craziness
screen.
of the 5 day a week soap format and like pursue web series or you know what I mean? Like, is there actually, should I try to like get it produced, but I have no idea where to begin with that. So we'll see. Yeah.
Wow, that would
Wow.
be amazing.
I'm in on both of those things.
It's like a I guess the log line is sort of like social justice soap opera. It's a kind of pulling from like the old school kind of golden era of daytime soap, which was much more kind of character driven and like responsive to its social context. And it's still a lot of like great twists and melodrama and all that, but like writing the sort of characters and context that were never represented that I feel like always should have been. So basically, there's only one character in the entire show that's white and cisgender and straight and a man.
I feel like that would play today. I feel like there's an
Yeah,
audience for this.
totally. It's the rival families are like a wealthy white family driven by a sort of toxic gay patriarch who's a real estate tycoon and has this like trans daughter who is sort of like his, right-hand woman and the most like him, but who he's kind of always taking for granted. And she can sort of see that it's about his trans misogyny, but he'll never say that out loud because he wants to be seen as this sort of liberal accepting whatever. And so kind of always gaslighting her around that. She's kind of like the diva manipulative character. The rival family is like this black political family. It takes place in a sort of mid-sized Midwestern city. And a lot of the sort of racial history of the city is sort of the context and backstory for the battle between these families. And one of the main heroes is this like from the black family is the young sort of trans man community organizer who's up against the real estate family on this campaign for how a piece of land's going to get used. And so it's the context, where like, I don't know, corporate boardroom shenanigans might be the focus on a on like a traditional soap. This sort of uses like urban community organizing and development and politics as sort of the stuff for that gets crossed with like the interpersonal soapy conflicts between the characters.
Tim,
I
it sounds like
need
you care enough about these characters to move
yes.
forward with
You
this. I
do,
mean,
and
if
I'm not used
that
to
was,
caring about characters. That's the thing.
I
Like,
don't think that's a
call me
question at
out.
all after hearing you
Yeah.
describe the project. I think you got to pursue this.
Yeah, and I need our listeners to listen to me. I need you to hear me right now, listeners. You do not fucking steal this idea, okay? This is Tim Jones Yelvington's idea.
Yeah, we're gonna
You
bleep
do
out
not.
random parts of that.
Yeah, that's right. It is their idea, not yours. It is such a good idea.
That's a great idea.
You
You gotta do that. I
know, I
love
always
it.
feel like the execution and how matter more than the stuff, so I've
Oh,
never
of
worried
course.
about that, but this is a space where I probably should worry more because it's less, it's this is not experimental fiction anymore, right?
That's
Like
right.
this is where like the idea is what you sell, like the content is what you sell, right? So yeah.
It sounds like you already have the show Bible, like you've done the
Exactly.
work,
Right.
Yeah.
I couldn't even describe the last novel I wrote that clearly or concisely, and I spent 5 years on it. I would just be mumbling at you, drooling. So I think this is the thing, Tim.
Amazing. Well, Tim, thank you so much for coming on. This has been incredible, and I
Yeah,
knew
thank
it would
you.
be.
Thank you. I had a great
Yeah, thank
time.
you. This was fun.
Everybody go get Tim's book. If you're in Chicago on September 30th, you're in for a treat. Go see Tim at the Guild Row. You'll put it up on your
Yes. Yeah.
socials and stuff.
So,
Okay.
but I get to
Okay.
work on that this week.
Awesome. It's called Don't Make Me Do Something We'll Both Regret. Tim Jones Yelvington, thank you so much.
Thank you.
That was fun.
That was good, right?
Yeah, I'm glad Tim came on. That was a fun conversation.
Tim's awesome. If you can catch them live, you should. Alex just got on Twitter and asked people to ask us questions.
And we have a whopping two.
Hey, thank you, listeners.
But they're both fun, so that's good.
It also is Saturday night. You know, who's on Twitter on Saturday night aside from us?
I don't know. God, I have no idea.
All right, what's the first one?
First one is from Adam Soldovsky, and he has this question for us. When is the I'm a Writer live tour in which cities? Thank you. So I think we should just answer this as like maybe give like the four cities you would want to hit
Okay.
because there ain't no tour happening, obviously.
Listen, if Adam Solodowski wants to start a GoFundMe
Sure.
to get us on a tour, we'll consider it.
We'll consider it.
All right, I'm gonna go with Chicago,
Okay.
Downers Grove.
Oh my God.
No, I would want to go west. I would want to go. You know what's really fun is the Twin Cities. I would go to the
I
Twin
love the
Cities.
Twin Cities,
Hell
sure.
yeah. I don't know, Texas. I'm trying not to say New York, because everyone would
Okay.
say New York. Maybe like upstate New York.
New York actually didn't occur to me.
Oh, look at
I was
you.
thinking Austin, because I have a friend there,
We have family there.
and North Carolina, because I think both of us have a ton of family there,
Yes.
somewhere in North Carolina. And then I would also want to go to somewhere in Canada,
Oh my God, what a good answer.
like Vancouver.
Vancouver, yes.
That would be, yeah, that would be it.
Vancouver, bring us to you, please. You're
Sure.
funny.
Wonder what the lit scene's like in Vancouver.
I bet it's good. Vancouver's,
Probably.
from what I hear, it's great.
Yeah.
So Adam, get that GoFundMe going.
And then the other question's a quick one, which I'm gonna let you handle. Who are the kids singing on your cool intro song?
Okay. Those are my kids.
Those are your kids.
Yeah. And the one that goes, yeah, the loudest and the longest is my youngest, my daughter, who's 4 now, but I think she was 2.
I didn't realize that
Yeah. Yep.
was her.
Yeah, she's a rebel. 'Cause like the two boys like stood obediently by the microphone and she like ran into the like behind us and was playing with her toys because I wanted her to do something, and that's a no. It's been like that for years, but she would chime in, and that was her work.
Yes.
What a legend.
The music was done by a best friend of mine from childhood, Max Loop.
So good.
We asked him for some like Rugratsy type music, and that's what he did. It turned out great.
Your references are always the best. Like when we were trying to describe what we wanted our logo to look like, mm-hmm. you just like came up, you just had right at the ready. Like, what was it? Like an automotive shop logo?
Yeah, I think you're right. I was anxious to hear what you're going to say because I couldn't remember what the generative image was. But yeah, I think you're right. It was an automotive shop.
And I was just like, I don't know, like chunky serif font. And you were like, I like this. And it was perfect.
Yeah. Thank you, Zach, forever.
Zach, we love you, Zach.
Anything new with you? Anything good?
All three kids started school on Monday. Knock wood.
Oh my God, Monday. For some reason, I thought they were middle of the week too. Mm-mm. Wow, Monday.
Monday, yeah. Yeah, and like when you have three kids or multiple kids, the work you have to do is exponential. Mm. Like I registered my daughter for preschool like as soon as I could, and I filled out all the forms and everything. And when we went to her orientation, I got a whole new packet of forms that needed to be filled out.
Yeah.
And then we went to the boys back to school night, and they got two new packets of forms that they had to fill out. And it's just like, it's fucking crazy how much
work. And then like the checklist of supplies, Britt and I were looking at that today, and it's just like paper plates this size, mm-hmm. googly eyes.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. And you can't get them in the stores. It's right. impossible. And you go on Amazon and everything's like backed up 2 weeks.
Yeah. It's all the same stuff. But thankfully
our school, you just pay them money and they buy what they want. So we just pay them a fee and then they
buy
it.
That's cool.
Yeah. It helps a lot. Nice. So that's the main thing. And I don't know. I can't believe it. I have like a lot of stuff to catch up on, including this podcast. And then like 2 weeks into school, I go do that Ragdale retreat.
Oh my God. Yeah.
Which is two nights over Labor Day weekend. I'm so excited about that. I'm hoping to have like all my work caught up by then so I can like actually write.
I feel like you're going to cry a lot. I don't mean that in a bad way. I mean that in a projecting way. I feel like if I had two nights to myself like that, I would just cry a lot.
Anytime I have alone time, I cry. Honestly, because you know, as parents, we're always like, okay, I'll feel that later. Right now, I just need to get through this.
Mm-hmm.
Like, I just need to get my kids fed or put to bed or, you know, whatever, right. like out of this tantrum. Yes. And later, I'll process that. And there's never a later. And so that's why I cry on my Peloton. Thank you, Christine Dercole. I love you. I'm excited. What about you? What's up with you?
Today was my soccer coaching debut.
Oh my God.
It was really fun. It was great. I mean, coaching is a really, the word coaching is doing a lot of work in that sentence. It's, you know, you're, there's no ref or anything for 4-year-olds. So, you know, the two coaches are on the field kind of helping and setting stuff up and keeping time and whatever. And it was fun. We have 8 girls on the team. And, you know, I'm trying to make sure everybody's playing equal amount of time and keeping mm-hmm. things fair and stuff. And I had anticipated that the hurdle to that happening would be the girls getting tired. And I was way off base. Oh. The hurdle was the girls. I mean, it doesn't matter that they're girls, they are girls, but the kids just having like meltdowns or like, you know, like wanting to go sit with mom for 5 minutes or like, and so a lot of it was just like, okay, are you in a good enough state? No, you're not. Okay. All right. I need you back out, bud. And all this stuff. And so it was pretty funny. We have two like fucking Pelés on the team and, or I should say like Mia Hamms and just like unbelievable. And all the other girls are doing a great job too, but it was funny to watch like wow, like at that age, especially the difference between the, you know, the kids who get it and the kids who don't is just like,
it's crazy.
It's a wide gulf.
Yeah, it happened on Parker's soccer team over the fall. My oldest, my 9-year-old, there was like one kid who was like an assassin out there. And like the other kids were like, they were doing a good job. Like they were staying
They were fine.
In.
Right.
They were doing what they could. But this kid, it was like, if Russick got the ball,
game over.
He was going to score. And so every time he got the ball, the parents would be like, yes, Russick, yes. And then we'd be like, and you're doing a good job too, Brady. You know, like that kind of stuff.
Yeah.
It's just hard not to get excited when you know the kid is so good.
Oh no, it was a blast. Yeah. So that's happening. My oldest kid is starting school. Next Friday.
Oh my goodness.
So second year pre-K, half day. Because we don't have full day available to us through public schools. Because that's why I was so tripped out when you said full day. I was like, wait, what? Mm-hmm. And then I didn't realize it was like, it's mandated right now.
I think before there was universal pre-K that you could do half day for both. And then there was like a couple years where you could only do half day for pre-K 3.
Got it.
While it was full day for pre-K 4. And now universal pre-K is only pre-K 4 and it's only full day.
Got it.
And I think that's to support working parents, you know? And I think even if we weren't putting Judith in the same school as the boys and having her still at the private school we had her in last year, I think she would still do full day pre-K because they offer it there. She's just ready.
Oh, like, yeah, no. I mean,
she freaking loves other kids and she loves, you know, all that stuff.
Definitely. My daughter would absolutely do full day. No hesitation. She would love it. So that's it.
That's it, man. Changes. That's how I feel. It's like,
yeah,
I don't even know what my life's gonna look like. I need to start making some money. If anyone has a lead on anything,
You should just post that you want to do like manuscript consultations or something. I feel like you would get a lot of
That's true. I should.
I would love to do that.
Yeah. No, I would love to do that. I absolutely love the few times that I've done it.
Yeah.
I just need like, I need to know what my income is going to be every month, you know, like I'm at that point. So I don't think I'd be able to have that luxury with editing, but maybe.
Sure.
So we'll see. If anyone wants to pay me $50 to see like the back of my knees or something or like my elbows.
Yeah, doing OnlyFans. Yeah.
I'll do that. $50. Or best
back,
offer.
$50 back of the knee. That's Listen.
I will Sharpie some boobs on the back of my knees. So you'll get like 2 for 1.
All right. Okay. Yeah.
See, I sweeten the pot. It's easy.
Yeah, that I mean, that whole situation changed really quickly, and then it just became a deal. So,
so we'll see. God. We'll see. Life is changing, but
yeah, in a
good way. All right.
All right, bud. See ya.
Bye. I'm a Writer, But is recorded by Alex Higley and me, Lindsay Hunter, in our respective basements. Editing by Lindsay Hunter. Music by Max Loop. Yeah.